This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Green Tea CR Phytosome Formula from Purity Products. It's the power of three of nature's top superfoods, a clinically tested green tea plus curcumin and resveratrol, all in one simple capsule. It's clinically proven to support your energy, vitality, and cardiovascular function. The secret behind Green Tea CR is its phytosome matrix, which boosts its green tea power by over 200% compared to regular green tea. Our friends at Purity Products have a free bottle for you to put to the test. Just pay $4.95 for shipping. Experience the power of this trio and see how good you can feel. Call 1-800-218-6030. That's 1-800-218-6030. Call now. As these move fast, dial 1-800-218-6030. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to discuss a subject that we so seldom touch upon, and that subject is plastic surgery. Plastic surgery is a field that has come along quite a lot in the past few years, and in particular, we're going to focus on hair restoration. Yeah, that is something that also we're seeing all kinds of innovations in that field. And yeah, hair's a big deal for both men and women. We're going to talk to board-certified plastic surgeon Gary Linkov. He's one of my good colleagues whose work is featured at Rebalance, which is a new center, a multidisciplinary center in Midtown Manhattan. Gary is an expert not just in plastic surgery. He's trained in plastic surgery. It was a very rigorous process. We're going to talk about the training that goes into that. But he has a very flourishing subspecialty in the field of hair restoration. So without further ado, welcome, Gary. It's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Yes, thank you so much, Dr. Hoffman. It's so great to be here with you and with your guests. I'm very happy and honored to be here with you today.
It's my pleasure. So, well, first of all, before we get into some of these breakthrough techniques. What type of training do board-certified plastic surgeons get? And was there additional training for your subspecialty, which is the hair restoration? Because, I got to say that when I was selecting medical specialties way back when I got my medical training, there was internal medicine, and that was 3 years, and then there was additional training in subspecialties, whether you pick endocrinology or cardiology, and that might last you, 4 or 5 years of training after medical school. But how many years did you go through to get to this stage where you're board certified?
Yeah, absolutely. I can definitely elaborate on my training. So after high school, going back to that point in my life, I went on to Cornell University for my undergrad. I was a psychology major as an undergraduate, so I think actually that does help me now in the line of work that I'm in, understanding human nature and where people are coming from. So I think it definitely plays a role.
That is a big component, because, and we'll talk a little bit about that, because sometimes we really have to kind of explore the motivations of patients. Right. We don't want patients to undergo multiple procedures and end up looking like some of these horrendo pictures of celebrities who've gone under the knife too many times.
Exactly right. That's a very valid point.
So back to your training. Yep.
Yes, exactly. After undergraduate training, I went on to do my medical degree at Columbia in Manhattan, and actually spent 5 years getting my medical degree, because I also, during that time, basically in the middle of medical school, did a separate year of head and neck cancer research at Memorial Sloan Kettering. So I had a growing interest in medical school, and
we actually saw a patient yesterday who was precisely treated for head and neck cancer at Memorial Sloan Kettering. A very innovative approach they use, because sometimes they don't use surgery. They use radiation and chemo in lieu of surgery when surgery is dicey.
Yes, Absolutely right. So that was 5 years of training in medical school with the additional year of research where I did everything from work on mice with different types of cancers to clinical research where we're studying basically different chart reviews and trying to figure out trends in the data. So after those 5 years, I went on to do head and neck surgery. So at that point, I really became interested in head and neck anatomy. So I was drawn to the sort of tactile feel of surgery and being able to have like an instant result that can improve someone's life. But I also really just like learning the anatomy of the head and neck. And what's interesting is that in medical school, when you're looking at the textbooks and even in the operating room, since you're always the furthest one from the actual patient, you're not really understanding the anatomy well because it's so three-dimensional. Mm-hmm. So I felt like I wanted to just learn more about it, and going off into training in head and neck surgery really allowed me to get super hands-on and to finally understand a lot of the different connections of the nerves and the blood vessels and the different many different structures that exist in the head and neck area.
It's kind of like the difference, you know, the difference between general anatomy and facial and neck anatomy is a little mm-hmm. bit like the difference between, I guess, general architecture, building a house versus manufacturing an exquisitely intricate Swiss watch. Because, you know, yeah, I know the basic muscles, I know the biceps, the triceps, you know, the deltoid, but when it comes to the facial muscles, there's so many of them, of them are involved. They're tiny, they're innervated by complex nerves, and there are many layers of them, and if you lose control over one or another of them, your whole aspect, your facial presentation will be changed.
No, that's absolutely right. And, you know, sometimes people will ask me, well, do you do cosmetic surgery or do you do like reconstructive surgery? And I always look at them and say, you know, it's really one and the same. And they look at me confused, like, what do you mean? It's one or the other. And I think the insurance companies would like us to believe that it's one or the other. But the truth is that it's always interconnected because, like you said, I mean, those muscles play different roles. And so sometimes there's a cosmetic manifestation of those muscles. Other times there's a functional, you know, implication. So you have to keep both in mind, whether you're rebuilding someone's face after cancer or you're trying to, you know, turn back the clock and make them look younger. I mean, it's always very much interrelated. So that anatomy and that just kind of thirst.
Yeah. So we got you through medical school, and I'm already feeling tired because you took an extra year. That boy, you're a nut for punishment.
Yes. Yes, I sure am. But you know, in my med school, about a third of us took time off for research. So it wasn't just to, you know, prove your resume and get in, you know, to the next step, but it was really to, because, you know, we just really enjoyed research for what it was worth. So that was a good year for me. No regrets. And so then I went on to head and neck surgery training in Philadelphia at the Temple Head and Neck Institute. And while there, you know, I was kind of drawn to a lot of the reconstructive procedures. I enjoyed the surgeries where people came in with broken jaws and we had to figure out a way to piece them back together, or they had a cancer removal on the face and there was a big hole and we're trying to think of ways to possibly repair it. And there are always many options. So I like the creative aspect of that. And also just like the suturing and sort of the procedural side of it too. So I definitely started to explore more of my interests in plastic surgery at that time during residency, and learning, you know, what else I had to do in terms of my training to get to the point where I could focus almost exclusively on plastic surgery of the head and neck.
And dealing with various forms of havoc, like gunshot wounds and burns and so on, because that's part of medical training, especially if you train in the inner city, that you're going to see a lot of mayhem.
Yes. It's amazing how routine those instances become. You know, normally you would never think of walking into a room where someone just got shot in the face. But then when you do it on call, you know, every week to 2 weeks, it almost becomes the routine, which is very odd.
So after one of those, a routine rhinoplasty would seem like a walk in the park.
Yes. However, rhinoplasty, believe it or not, I think is one of the most challenging procedures.
But the lexicon, it's basically a nose job. Okay.
Yes. And there were just a lot of nuances that go into nose surgery, and also the expectations are usually greater than that of like a gunshot wound victim. Mm-hmm. So both can be extremely challenging. But yeah, I mean, from the standpoint of the gruesomeness of it, rhinoplasty is really not much. But getting it just right, exactly what the patient kind of intended or wanted in their mind's eye, is challenging, especially when you're worrying about the functional component, like making sure they still breathe well. You know, it used to be that people did nose jobs and they just wanted to make the nose smaller because that's what the majority of people asked for. Nowadays, the paradigm has shifted to recreating structure and not making the nose smaller because people used to be made into nose cripples. They couldn't breathe for the rest of their life. And getting that cartilage that was removed back later on is actually very difficult and quite challenging and morbid if you need to rebuild the nose. So the key is to actually not remove more than you have to. So that whole part,
it's harder to rebuild than to take away.
I mean,
So the actual fellowship that you underwent, that was very daunting to me when at one point I contemplated a surgical residency. It's very tough, and it lasts a long time. You did head and neck surgery for how many years?
For 5 years.
5 years. Okay, because medicine, 3 years, we got by easy.
Yeah, right. And then I did fellowship at Washington University in St. Louis, which was is considered one of the top academic programs in the country, and that was specifically in facial plastics and reconstructive surgery. So that was a combination of the more cosmetic aesthetic types of cases, but also heavy duty reconstructive work as well. So it kind of built on some of my early experiences in residency, and spent the full year only doing facial plastic surgery. So that was a wonderful year. I had a chance to spend time not just with the academicians at the big hospital, but also with some of the private practice folks in St. Louis who were at the top of their game and doing amazing work. So and actually who have trained a lot of the top surgeons in Beverly Hills and New York City. It's kind of just happens that way. A lot of them have gone through St. Louis during their training.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Each step though is another application process, another selection process, and kudos for you for making the cut because it's hard to get into a plastics residency. It's popular because obviously it's a lucrative field. There are a lot more applicants than there are places for plastic surgery in this country. I have to say, one of the problems that I have with plastic surgery, and, I feel I'm a little bit, with a medical background, I'm kind of an expert in this, is I can go to a party and pretty quickly I can spot who's had substandard plastic surgery because it's pretty obvious. There's a look, and that look is nondescript, featureless, characterless. There's a uniformity of plastic surgery outcomes. So, having all this technical expertise, that's great. But where do you derive your aesthetic sense from? Because I know of plastic surgeons, some of whom are artists and sculptors, and they transfer their aesthetic sense to the palate, because this is a palate that's even more complex than clay because it's living tissue and it has to heal.
Yes. I'll get it definitely into that. I just wanted to point out that there are many plastic surgeons who are excellent surgeons, and they actually avoid procedures on the face because to many people, it's stress provoking. It's difficult, and people's expectations are obviously extremely high for their face. So. Mm-hmm. So even amongst plastic surgeons, there's, I would say a big percentage that tries to avoid it because they can do many other types of surgeries that are more stress-free. So coming back to, some of my early inspirations for, later on leading to this field, were definitely also in the art realm. I took different drawing classes, painting classes since fourth grade. My parents enrolled me in different types of courses that I really enjoyed. And then actually between undergrad and med school, I spent 6 weeks in Florence, Italy, just taking a sketching class. So every day we'd go to a different museum. There's so many in Florence and some of the neighboring towns. And we would just sketch what we were seeing and get feedback for it. So that was great. And then also in college, I took a sculpture class, and we had to basically sculpt a bust of one of our classmates and sort of had to do it of each other. So it was a very interesting experience. I still remember when our instructor came up to my bust, like sort of early on in the process, and said, you know, something looks off here, the proportions are a little off. And he literally used this one type of sculpture device and just shaved off half of the face that I had worked for weeks to build. And that was sort of a demoralizing day, but it really sort of helped me hone my skills and vision of the proportions. And I understood later why he had done that. And I think the ultimate result was much better. So, you know, I think on the face and doing surgery on the face, you definitely have to have an artistic eye. Before we use anything like a knife, you have to mark out the face. And so you're essentially just drawing on the face, trying to envision what it will look like. So definitely those early experiences factor into my sort of everyday life now. Absolutely.
Do you ever use software with your patients to help them envision what the modification might look like? Because, I mean, that's a little bit like, you know, what architects do when they say, well, this is what the room's going to look like. We'll create a simulation.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I use it for rhinoplasty simulation. I think it's a really effective tool for that because oftentimes people don't really know what they want their nose to look like. Mm-hmm. They just know that there's something off and they want it different. And it's difficult in a consultation just by showing them to for the patient to envision, like, what will that look like if I don't have a hump? So I think it's really effective to use software. I specifically use Photoshop because a lot of the programs out there that are sold by different companies are just an offshoot of Photoshop. So I'm comfortable in Photoshop, so I use that, and I'm able to use
You're a photographer as well, so presumably you play around with that software.
Right, exactly right. Mm-hmm. So that's what I use, and I show people what they might look like. But the danger of overusing that type of software, especially for other types of or all types of you know, face plastics procedures, is that you can definitely give people a false sort of false advertising and make them believe, hey, they're going to look like this, and then when they don't, they'll be fairly upset at you. So I think there's a kind of a good kind of healthy place where, you know, you can fit the software utilization in, but sort of not underdo it and not overdo it, just like most other things. If you're doing it on everyone, you're showing them how all their aging face results will be, you'll have many, I think, dissatisfied patients because some results are more challenging to predict. But I think for rhinoplasty, in good hands, you really can estimate what they'll look like. And I think most patients appreciate that.
You know, when people go for plastic surgery, they have options. You know, if they want to do the bags under their eyes, they can actually see an ophthalmologist, an eye doctor, or sometimes dermatologists do procedures, or sometimes ENTs, ear, nose, and throat doctors, will do nose jobs. So is there an advantage to seeing a board-certified plastic surgeon?
Yeah, I think there definitely is. These days, the training for plastic surgery is definitely becoming more and more subspecialized. So my training was in head and neck surgery and with additional training in facial plastics, and then I did hair restoration surgery training after that. But for there are other paths, so you can do sort of a general kind of full body plastic surgery training. The problem there is that most of the times those residents are not being taught facial plastic surgery because that has already sort of been pushed off into a different subspecialty.
Because there's the tummy tucks and there's liposuction and there's breast augmentation or reduction procedures and all that stuff.
Right, and butt lifts that people are doing, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't do any of those procedures, partly because I have no interest and partly because that wasn't my core training. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to go to someone who has solid core training in a type of plastic surgery that they're doing. So for example, if there is a complicated eye procedure, so some eye plastics procedures are extremely involved and they start to involve like the inner workings of the eye. So for a case like that, I would also refer somebody to someone who's ocular plastics trained, meaning that they went through ophthalmology and then they did usually 2 years of eye plastics. Okay. So I think it's difficult for people sometimes to capture what type of training the person had, because there's also another route. There's oral surgeons. So basically someone who became a dentist, then decided to go back and do oral surgery. And then they have a few fellowships out there in the country for cosmetic surgery. So they are actually dentists who have been trained to also do breast augmentation and all types of other things.
A dentist who does breast augmentation?
Well, after some additional training, So I think, you know, and many times on people's websites, it's difficult to exactly understand what type of training they did. So I definitely appreciate when I go to people's websites when they're honest about where they came from, and then you can better understand where their expertise lie. So that, I think, is very important. So, you know, plastic surgery is now basically somewhat fragmented. And there are those who do solely sort of very basic cosmetic procedures like liposuction. Then there are those who do very complicated reconstructive, like free flap surgeries to rebuild, you know, large portions of the body.
Yes, yeah, so someone's had a devastating accident or their face has gone through, a windshield or something. And, you know, they have all kinds of gruesome injuries. There's even facial transplants these days. I mean, really going into some very high-tech procedures.
That's right. So I think some people are cross-trained fairly well into some areas that maybe aren't their core training or aren't a part of their core training. But finding out what their background exactly is and what they do a lot of in their current practice, I think, is super important for any patient looking to, you know, have any sort of plastic surgery done for any reason, really, whether it's cosmetic or not. So those are all important questions to ask.
What about managing expectations? You say you have a psychology background. What sort of psychological issues come up in when patients consult you? You know, the realistic expectations, quirky demands of patients. How do you cope with that?
Well, that's a whole big discussion. So there are many different aspects. There are basically certain red flags that I think many plastic surgeons look for, and if they don't look for them, they probably should. So one is a patient who's had, you know, say 20, 30 different types of plastic surgeries before, and they're still coming back unhappy. So I always ask, even if someone has had just one plastic surgery in the past, I always ask them, like, are you happy with the results? And it doesn't mean that if they say that they're unhappy, that that's a huge red flag. But if they're unhappy, I really sort of want to know why. Is it because there was a complication and the surgeon failed to, you know, kind of hold their hand through the process or didn't want to revise their work? Or do they just think it doesn't look good? So anytime someone's had any prior work done, I'm always sort of probing and looking for certain types of answers to help gauge, like, how will they respond to my surgery potentially? Because if they were so unhappy with 20 prior plastic surgeries from, say, 5 different plastic surgeons, the odds of me making them happy with my procedure are probably almost zero.
Do the initials BDD resonate for you?
Yes, body dysmorphic disorder.
Okay, right.
Absolutely. And some people actually offer screening tests for their patients. They have them fill out certain questionnaires that help get. I honestly prefer not to, and I don't think that the answers on those questionnaires are foolproof. So I basically do my own assessment. But absolutely, BDD is a huge issue in plastic surgery.
Because people were never satisfied with their body image. They have a relentless pursuit of some ideal that's an ever receding mirage.
Correct. Yes. So one other fact that I look for is, are they unhappy with one basic trait that I see to be an issue myself? Mm-hmm. Or are there many, many different traits that they're complaining mm-hmm. about, mm-hmm. some of which I don't even see what they're referring to? You know, if they look, point to their nose and say, my nose is too wide, and my aesthetic eye, and based on certain aesthetic principles, the nose does not look wide. I mean, I basically will confront them and tell them that. And if they insist on it, then I'm clearly not the right person for them. Mm-hmm. So I think honesty in the whole process, I think really trying to understand mm-hmm. people's motivations. One other issue
the motto, the customer is always right, is not necessarily applicable to plastic surgery. You're not just a mercenary, a hired gun who's going to do whatever client desires.
Correct. Yeah, you have to choose wisely for, I think, the patient's sake and for your own sake and the practice's sake, because, you know, one patient can really these days do a lot of harm to someone's reputation with the way the internet works and that sort of thing. So mm-hmm. so absolutely, I think it's a two-way street. So, you know, I'll rarely tell patients this, but the truth is when you walk into the plastic surgeon's office, as much as you're sort of sizing them up and evaluating them, they're doing the same to you. Mm-hmm. And it really is a big decision to enter into sort of that contract with someone to say that I'm going to make changes to your face that we've agreed on. And, you know, that's a big deal. So I treat it with, you know, with a lot of humility.
Gary, this is a good point at which to pause because we divide our podcast into two parts. I want to reserve some time in part two to talk about specific treatments for hair restoration, which is one of your subspecialties. Also talk a little bit more about plastic surgery. So we'll pause for just a moment. We invite our listeners to check back in with us for part two of our discussion with Gary Linkoff. He is a board-certified plastic surgeon, currently works at Rebalance, a new center in Midtown Manhattan. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast, and I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman.